This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of July 2nd, here are a few top stories. In the news, this week, the Phoenix City Council approved money for a study of officer-involved shootings. From the show, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
As part of the Phoenix City Council's meeting today, council members will consider whether to approve an officer-involved shooting study. The Phoenix Police Department wants to enter into an agreement with the National Police Foundation to figure out why there have already been 28 officer-involved shootings so far in 2018. The foundation has said it could finish its report within 6 months of approval. Police Chief Jerry Williams is leading the push to have the foundation do the study, and she's with me to explain more. Chief, why is this important to you, and why is it important for an outside entity to do the study?
That's actually a great question. So any good organization, be it a business, police organization, law enforcement entity, is not afraid to have people come in and look at us to look at the best practices, things that we may want to improve on. Steve, in all honesty, the ultimate goal for me is to answer the question why. Why have we had 28 officer-involved shootings? And I'm not making light of it by any stretch of the imagination, because when we think of those, every single officer-involved shooting has at least two people who are in some kind of dynamic where there's a struggle. It could be multiple officers. It could be the subject who's involved. But for me not to ask the question why, for me not to research why, for me not to use a professional foundation that has done this type of work in other organizations, I think is irresponsible.
If the council gives the go-ahead, what's the sort of work, what's the sort of research that the foundation, what kind of questions can they ask?
So the foundation, in speaking with them, and I've talked to two other entities to look into who would be the best person for the study. I have engaged the labor organizations in at least two of the instances, or two entities who would look at us. And this was the one that the unions didn't have as much of an issue with. So they're going to look at a statistical analysis over 5 to 10 years of our officer-involved shooting patterns. They're going to look at our policy. They're going to look at our training. They're going to look at our practices. They're going to look at the individuals who were involved in this officer-involved shooting. So it's a two-way street. It's not just looking at PD. It's also going to be looking at those individuals that we engaged with. What they will not do, because that's now kind of some of the spin, is that they will not ask questions or draw any conclusions as to the justification of the officer's use of force. But what I like about the foundation is that they have access to 1,200 data points of agencies across the country so that they can compare us to other entities. So that comparison is critically important. I know in some of the conversations that we had at Public Safety, there were community members from Phoenix who talked about their being able to run this study. This is broad. This is vast. Our unique dynamic of 28 officer-involved shootings is not happening any other place in the country. I need to know why.
Is this a more dangerous place generally for officers, for anybody else now?
That's a good question. And as a resident, as a community member, as someone who's raised children in this this city, I would say no. What I will say is that we're having this anomaly of 28 persons who made a conscious choice to be violent against officers. So when you're violence against officers, I'm going to broaden that. Mm-hmm. When you're violence towards officers, you are violent towards your community. In at least a couple of instances, four people were murdered prior to us even getting on scene. So is the city of Phoenix a dangerous place, more dangerous than anyone else? I would say no. But there is this interesting dynamic and anomaly that's going on that's creating the dynamic where I am using funds that I have in my own budget to really try to figure out the why.
We had that horrible situation in Dallas, of course, where officers were actually targeted. And that's almost sort of part two of the question I just asked, which is there a situation where officers are being put into even more delicate, tough situations because maybe people are just not feeling as good about officers as they did, certain people?
That's what I think this study is going to find. So in our briefings post any of these officer-involved shootings, we have a briefing on scene. Some of the similarities we're finding in these instances, so there are mental health issues, there are substance abuse issues, there are a combination of a number of issues, and a lot of them, our officers are having to engage with individuals and react to the threat posed to them within less than 2 minutes. So to make that quick judgment call, to have people point guns at, to have people shoot at our officers is a dynamic that is happening. So do I think they are being predators toward the officers? I don't think so, but I'm hopeful this study will get to the baseline of that.
You obviously have great respect for your officers. You have high expectations
Absolutely.
For them. When this kind of thing happens, do you ever get a little sniff of doubt in your mind to think, not a particular officer, but just, are these situations becoming such that we need to do different sorts of training or something like that?
And that's always a great question. So with every incident, we learn something. And it would be irresponsible on our part to not to create training scenarios and dynamics. So we've actually taken the proactive step to create various training scenarios based on what we've learned in the previous 27 incidents, to create real-time training for our officers so that they have the mindset going in to know that they need to make adjustments, cues, what to look for, what not to look for, how to engage, how to discuss. So I'm not waiting for a study to do that. Proactive police departments really take the lead on making sure that we're providing the up-to-date, fast, quick training. I will say this, I love my city. I love my officers. I just need to get my hands around some of the data sets and information as to why. So then we could hand that information off to the Arizona State University folks, who will then engage our community. So they'll have the data, they'll have the research, they'll have the information. Then they can take that and then run through this scenario and situations with our community members.
Do you expect the council to ask a certain kind of question?
Well,
I think it might just be budget related.
I am hopeful it's not going to be budget related. What we heard in the public safety subcommittee were voices from individuals in the community who make reference to officers murdering people. That's a little sticking point with officers. We didn't murder people. So my officers engaged in individuals who had violence towards us and or community members, and they were forced to react to that. The last thing a police officer wants to do, and anybody who wears a badge will tell you, you can ask anyone this across the country, the last thing we want to do is have to engage in deadly force. However, we arrive to scenes and circumstances. We have four dead people already. What do you expect us to do? We arrive to scenes and circumstances, and people are pointing guns at, they're shooting at my officers. What do you expect the outcome to be? So the ultimate goal is to create the dynamic where we have training, we have policies, we have practices, we have community members who believe in us, and credibility is key and important. And to have the Police Foundation come in as that overreaching umbrella is going to be key. So I'm hopeful that council will ask those kind of questions. I do know that there's some opposition from at least one of our labor organizations who say that we know why people are shooting or why our officers are shooting. To some degree, I do understand why we are doing that also, but there's a bigger question. I can't be the police chief and have 28 shootings happen in my city and not solicit or ask for an outside entity to come look at us.
Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams, pleasure to have you.
Thanks. Steve.
From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's a little something different from host Lauren Gilger.
I wonder who tried to kill us.
Yeah, I'm wondering that too. In fact, I'm kind of freaking out about it.
Well, usually when someone tries to kill me, it's because I'm onto something.
To the glistening eastern sea, I give you Queen Lucy, the Valiant.
I volunteer as tribute.
I believe we have a volunteer.
Nancy Drew, Lucy Pevensey, Katniss Everdeen. We all know some of these classic heroines in young adult literature. They're strong, enterprising, and brave. But according to our next guest, one of the most interesting trends in young adult lit today is that female protagonists are breaking down some of those barriers. Kelly Roberts is an associate professor of English at Meredith College in North Carolina, and she's recently written about how female protagonists in young adult fiction have changed and stayed the same. And she says it's not just about traditional heroines anymore.
I think we have gotten to the point now where we think not only can girls dream big when they're female protagonists in young adult literature, but they can dream small, right? That the very fact of their being is significant now for female protagonists. They do not have to be a warrior. They can be something like a whispering warrior. They can be an unlikely heroine. They're not really seeking the spotlight. They're not trying to be grandiose. They're trying to be themselves. And they show their humanity in that way. They are flawed characters, which is, of course, nothing new, but the fact that we are seeing very strong, but incredibly human and incredibly flawed female characters who are strong in that vein is something that I think is significant.
Yeah. Let's start by talking about some of those unlikely heroines that you mentioned there. Give us an example or two of those.
I think the example that comes to mind today is the character of Marin in Nina LaCour's young adult novel, We Are Okay. It just recently won the Prince. And I love that example because it is an example of a female protagonist who's really going through this incredible arc of grief. She has lost her mother when she was very young. She grew up with her grandfather, whom she loved very, very much, on the West Coast. But she loses him right before her freshman year of college. And instead of finding out that, you know, and kind of getting affirmed in all of these wonderful things she knew about him as a result of going through his things, she realizes that he was a very complicated man and someone that she didn't quite know as well as she thought she did. And so she goes to New York, really homeless, all on her own, kind of drops everything and goes to get ready for college a few weeks early, and really works through her first semester of college just learning how to be in the world and learning how to love people who are not necessarily all the things that you grew up believing they were. What really drives this book is the idea that you can be confused, you can be complicated, you can be struggling, and yet in the end, as she says, you can really be okay. And in that way, she shows such a quiet strength that I think it is kind of a new thing that we're seeing in young adult literature, that she's just a beautifully conflicted and complicated young woman who can rest in that and simply be strong in herself. So I think it's a beautiful example of how you don't have to be Katniss in order to be a wonderfully strong female protagonist these days.
You also talk about, you're talking about these characters who are flawed as well. Like this is, and that's nothing new in literature, but it does seem to be a rising trend, you say, in young adult heroines. What do you think the attraction is to characters like this? Why do you think these are the characters we're seeing more and more today?
Well, I think we're kind of growing up. I think young adult literature has always had female characters who are strong, but these female characters seem to avoid kind of the tidy endings or the polished edges that when we were trying to make sure that girls got the idea that you can be strong and brave, some of that was needed. But I think the beautiful thing is now we don't feel the need to tidy everything up or to have some Wonder Woman at the end. There's a wonderful young adult book called The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas. Wonderful example of how the female protagonist, Star Carter, is kind of navigating lots of things. Something very, very heavy happens to her best friend, and he's gunned down in a police incident. But she's working through that, doesn't handle everything incredibly well, navigates like the rest of us would. But she does show humanity in all of that by, you know, doing what a conflicted character would do. And I think in that way, she does redefine strong.
Yeah. So you said in your work, you get to talk to a lot of young teenagers, the people who are reading these books. Is your sense that they are more attracted to sort of almost more realistic characters? It's not fantastic. It's not necessarily a grand adventure, but it's people who they can really relate to?
I think that is true, you know, in general. The wonderful thing about young adult literature right now is that, you know, we have voracious readers. And when I meet the people who are reading young adult literature, everyone has a favorite genre. So definitely science fiction and fantasy is a huge genre right now with young adult literature. But we do have some incredible female protagonists. And the people who really gravitate toward that genre have the same feeling, I think, that the people who gravitate toward more realistic fiction have. And that is that whether they are Katniss Everdeen or, you know, they are much more realistic character, everyone doesn't have to come out in the end as being incredibly perfect, having figured everything out and having very tidy endings. Every character gets to be flawed and still on her way of making herself into an adult. And I think that's something that that resonates with everyone.
Yeah. You also bring up, though, the fact that while we're seeing sort of this wider variety of heroines in young adult literature, that they're not necessarily more diverse. What do you think is contributing to that? Like, who's writing these characters?
Well, I think the idea of who's writing the characters is very, very significant. I would be remiss without saying we have some amazing young adult authors who are themselves diverse. You know, Jacqueline Woodson is a person who comes to mind with Brown Girl Dreaming and Another Brooklyn. There's a wonderful 13-year-old activist named Marley Diaz who is trending with hashtag 1000 Black Girl Books. And I'm just so excited that the people who are reading these books are taking really the forefront in making sure that we have diverse characters out there. So it's an incredibly exciting time to be in young adult literature and to think about diversity. But in my opinion, we've never had a more important time in our country to really embrace diversity and inclusion.
All right. Kelly Roberts is an associate professor of English at Meredith College in Raleigh, North Carolina. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this today.
Thank you.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Mariana Dale on our original production, The Show.
The Invest in Ed petition signature effort began on the heels of the Red for Ed marches, walkouts and walk-ins on behalf of teachers and overall education funding in Arizona. In order to get on the November ballot, the group behind Invest in Ed needed to collect more than 150,000 valid signatures. And I spoke with one of the effort's leaders, David Lujan, who said that goal has been achieved.
We are turning in 270,000 signatures. 150,000 of those were collected by volunteers, so it's a historic and unprecedented effort, unprecedented not only in Arizona, but we think in the nation. And I think it's a real testament to how many people out there are so eager to see this on the ballot and have the funding for our schools.
David, how did this happen? I mean, it was amazing the momentum coming out of the Red for Ed. The people saw the thousands of people marching. They saw them at the Capitol. But to think, I'm sure you heard this 100 times, well, it's going to be too hot. It's going to be really hard to collect these. What happened? What were you seeing from the community?
You know, what I heard from a lot of the petition gatherers is how easy it was to get the signatures. People were eager to sign. They wanted to sign. They know how underfunded our schools have been, and they want to put the resources into them. And so it's exciting. It's exciting for the students in Arizona, and it's a great day.
You've been in politics a long time. Do you expect challenges to the signatures, and how do you think that's going to go?
We do. I mean, there's always challenges to these things, but we are confident. You know, we are well over the 150,000 threshold that was needed to turn in these petitions, so we think our signatures are good. You know, this is going to get on the ballot, and if it gets on the ballot, our polling has showed that it has strong public support. But more so than polling, collecting 270,000 signatures in 60 days, I think, is a pretty strong statement in itself.
I mean, can you give me just that human element? What does that feel like at this point?
It just feels amazing. It's, you know, all those teachers who marched on the Capitol for the Bread for Ed, you know, they were frustrated leaving the session because it wasn't quite the ending they wanted. And so we wanted to make sure that this is something that they can work for towards November. And so just I think the excitement among educators, among students and parents, it's really just it's a great feeling. And now we have the work to do to make it sure it passes in November.
So what's the message that's going to be out there starting later this morning? And then as you move into the days, I presume there can't be any resting on the laurels, but can there be at least a deep breath first before you start the next battle?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's just marching forward and telling people what the message is. And this is about putting resources into Arizona classrooms. Our schools today, even with what happened in the legislature just past session, are still $800 million below 2008 funding levels. And so here's an answer to put dedicated revenue into our schools in a manner that the legislature cannot touch.
Now, you and I have talked about this a little bit before when the announcement was first made about Invest in Ed, that there are a lot of people who are skeptical about once voters actually see the taxes are being raised and on whom, there's going to be a fight there. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of opposition to it now, even stronger than what you've gotten so far. There's going to be money coming out against it. Is the goodwill toward teachers, the reality that there needs to be more money in the classrooms, is that going to be enough to overcome what's going to be a really hard effort, one would think, against it?
I think so. What we've heard from people and what's interesting from our polling that we've done just recently since the legislative session ended was, you know, there was a lot of, it's about the 20 by 20 and Governor Ducey has been running commercials about how much funding our teachers are getting. And so we wanted to see, do people still feel that there's a need for more funding? And the polling has shown that Arizonans overwhelmingly feel that this is needed. And so I think that's going to continue. I think people see the need and they see past all of this sort of messaging that is really inaccurate in many regards. And so they want to put the resources into the schools because it's that important.
At the core of this, what's the most important message that the Invest in Ed effort can get out there? Underfunded schools, yes, but is there something stronger than that, or something even more specific than that?
I think it's about this is for Arizona, because what we have heard from business leaders for the last few years that the best way to grow our economy is to create a skilled workforce and a strong public education system. And this is going to provide the resources to do both. And when we do that, that means jobs and a stronger economy for all Arizona.
A center-right state, let's say, even though there have been a lot of Democrats elected who've done a lot of great things, it's still considered this way. Is this changing the dynamic?
I think so. I think, you know, what we've seen in the past year, not only with this, Red for Ed, the March for Our Lives, the students, the SOS putting the ESA referendum on the ballot, you know, people are frustrated with lack of action at our state capitol, so they're taking power into their own hands. And so, and it's for the priorities that Arizonans care about, because we don't always see those priorities being addressed at our state capitol. So the people of Arizona are saying, okay, let's do it ourselves.
David, is there any work in tandem with anyone else? I mean, if this is private, I get it, but even with the SOS fighting against the expanded vouchers program, is there a way of strategically, are you thinking in terms of that? Are you thinking, let's get together with other educators to be in favor of this one and against this other one?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a strong case to be made that, and SOS is on our advisory committee for the Invest in Ed initiative. So I would imagine we'd be working in partnership with a lot of this, and, you know, voting yes on our proposition and voting no on the ESAs is something that I think most Arizonans can easily do.
David Lujan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Today is the last day for those trying to get citizen initiatives on the November ballot to turn in their hundreds of thousands of signatures to the Secretary of State's office, where they will be counted and verified. Invest in Ed is one of the major initiatives making headlines today. Last hour on the show, we spoke with David Lujan, one of the leaders of that movement, more about it. And KJZZ's Mariana Dale is at the state capitol, where those leaders just held a press conference and turned in those signatures to the Secretary of State's office, and she joins us now. Good morning, Mariana.
Good morning, Lauren.
So before we get into the press conference today and the signatures, this initiative comes on the heels of the Red for Ed movement. Remind us, what's in this initiative?
Yeah, so this initiative, Invest in Ed, is what's seen as a solution to improve public education funding in Arizona. What it would do is almost double the income tax on some of the highest earners in Arizona. So what does that mean? That's people who earn more than $250,000 a year, households that earn more than $500,000 a year, and then a slightly larger increase would go to individuals who earn more than $500,000 a year and households that earn more than $1 million a year. And they're estimating that this tax alone would bring $690 million in new funding to public education classrooms.
So what was the scene like there this morning when they made this announcement? They've been gathering hundreds of thousands of signatures. Was there excitement there?
Oh, there was jubilance for sure. I would say there is at least 200 people here, everyone wearing their trademark red shirts. And I should say that everyone here was very excited, despite the fact that it is already in the 90s here this morning, even in the shade. People were excited to see that their hard work had paid off, because not only do they think they have enough signatures to get this on the ballot, that's 150,000 signatures,
right.
They estimate they collected more than 270,000 signatures. Now, that's really important, because not every signature is necessarily going to be validated. What happens now is that these signatures are evaluated by the Secretary of State, and some might be thrown out if people aren't actually registered to vote, or if they're not belonging to real people. And mm-hmm. so it's really important for this movement to be successful that they have that cushion. And 110,000 more extra signature, 110,000 extra signatures, that's quite a cushion.
Now. That's much more of a cushion than they probably needed to get. So with that kind of energy behind this, what are they saying about their chances that voters across the state will approve this, assuming it gets on the ballot in November?
So we heard this morning from Joe Thomas, who's from the Arizona Education Association, and they say that this ballot measure is based on years of research that they've done, polling people, trying to figure out what exactly they would support. And so they are confident that people are going to be willing to support this tax on the wealthy to bring more education funding to the state.
All right, that's KJZZ's Mariana Dale at the state capitol updating us on the Invest in Ed initiative. Mariana, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lauren.
From the Science Desk, here's a conversation from KJZZ's The Show with Steve Goldstein and Lauren Gilger.
Wildfires start as a line of smoke snaking through the treetops into the sky. If no one's around to see it, well, they can get big before help is on the way. That's why lookouts across the state dutifully climb the steps to their posts and isolated towers. There, they scan the tree line for any sign of fire patiently, hour after hour. And believe it or not, in this day and age, this method is still relied on by firefighters and other agencies. At its peak, Arizona had 120 of these towers, and 75 still stand today, according to the Forest Fire Lookout Association, and only about half are used during the fire season. But those that are crucial to forest safety. I caught up with Shirley Payne, a longtime lookout at Baker Butte Lookout Tower. She spoke to me from her post in the tower about her day-to-day job.
We don't just sit up here. We don't just call in fires. We also relay messages to the other Forest Service people on the ground, firefighters. It's right now, it's really intense because we are in such extreme fire danger that everybody's sort of on pins and needles waiting. It's scary because I think it could be a fire season like we had in 2002 or 2011 with the Rodeo Cheniska and the Walla fire. It could happen. So we're just waiting. Hopefully we get a lot of rain and not so much lightning.
Is that something that you think about all the time?
Oh, yeah. It's a pretty ongoing thing. You almost hate to go down out of your tower afraid you're going to miss something because all it takes doesn't take long for it to take off. Seems to me also that the fires are burning hotter this year, not so much on the ground that they take off, and it's black and brown when the fire's over, whereas a lot of the fires, it just burns the forest floor.
Can you give us an idea of what you're doing to keep yourself sharp and also just to, in some ways, to pass the time as you prepare and get ready to relay messages or learn what's going on?
Oh, well, that's easy. I keep busy. I read a lot. Mm-hmm. I do quilting, needlepoint. When I'm feeling tired, I do laps around the tower. Mm-hmm. 80 times is 1 mile. That means I'm talking about the catwalk on the tower.
Yeah.
I'm not really lonely. I have my dog here, and recently I have a horse, and my horse stays here with me at the tower.
People are going to want to know what kind of dog you have.
Of course. Black lab. His name is Jeffrey.
that's great. Could you describe the tower?
My tower isn't very tall. It's only 40 feet with three flights. Some are as high as 110 feet, but I am not far from the highway. I'm very accessible. People can hike up or drive up to my tower. Some of the towers are hike-in only. I'm very fortunate. I have a cabin here. Actually, I call it my castle, with hot running water and a shower inside. So I'm pretty fortunate. I didn't always have hot running water. I used to have a pump for years where I had to pump the water and heat it and outdoor shower and all that. But they've improved and I'm uptown now.
When you are in the tower and preparing and doing your work, what kind of tools do you use? Do you have a pair of binoculars? Do you have other things? What do you use to scope out what you're doing?
Well, first off, I do use binoculars, and I do have a Osborne firefinder, which it's an instrument that's on a pedestal, and it has a 360 degrees, turns around. There's the eyesight. You look through and you sight your smoke on the crosshairs and you give them your reading. When you call in a fire, you say Flagstaff Baker Butte Fire Flash. Then they'll say, go ahead, and you give them your azimuth reading, your distance, how far away, if there's a landmark. One thing is, it takes a good 6 years to know your tower, and that means all the landmark. And it's changing. It changes all the time. It depends what time of day it is, what time of year it is, the shadows, the clouds. Top smoke is deceiving. It looks like it's close. It could be 10 miles farther.
Wow.
So you always pray you get your distance right, or pray for a cross from another tower. So we triangulate. If several towers see it and they give their reading, then they, in the dispatch office, they have a cross map where they can pinpoint exactly where the fire is, and then they'll dispatch whoever area of response it is and go from there. And then we give smoke updates, whoever calls in the fire. If it's getting bigger, darker, black, the darker the smoke, the heavier the fuels, light smoke. And also, you know, if you're not sure if it's a fire, you can call it in anyways. It could be somebody's big campfire. But they can always call it a false alarm.
Shirley Payne is a lookout at Baker Butte Lookout Tower, and she'll be up there through this season with her trusty dog, Jeffrey.
On the more high-tech side of the spectrum, there are also people trying to figure out how we can use technology to improve the way we detect wildfires. I caught up with Marong Ha. She's a recent graduate of ASU. And last semester, she and two other students worked on a project that uses artificial intelligence to detect wildfires before they grow. It's a project that hits home for her. When she was still in high school in 2007, she had to evacuate with her parents when several wildfires hit Southern California.
I come home one day and my parents told me that, hey, you know, we're under mandatory evacuations because of the wildfires. School was canceled for an entire week. Work was canceled. We went to stay with our friend in Irvine. And it was just a very traumatic experience because I saw pictures of, you know, my friends who had to evacuate to places like Qualcomm Stadium for a week. We had classmates who lost their homes to the fires. We ended up being okay. Our home was okay. But nonetheless, it was kind of one of those things you never really, you know, we had snow days when I lived in Michigan. Never thought we had fire days, you know, in California.
They're calling the project Prometheus. It took fourth place in the National Microsoft Imagination Cup in May. And now they're going on to compete for $100,000 from Microsoft next month. I spoke with her more about her project and how she and her classmates are now working with local governments to try to put it into practice.
You know, our goal is to have a drone fly over a forest area or a national park or even, you know, a residential area with, you know, a lot of wood. And what it does is it'll map out the area with the camera that's built in. So it'll take pictures, and then those pictures will get fed into a machine learning algorithm that will then look for signs of a fire in those pictures.
So like a small area that is heat or smoke coming out?
Yeah, so how we trained the algorithm was we found all of these videos of wildfires. And then we took screen grabs of the videos and tagged the areas that had fires and then told the machine, hey, you know, in these pictures, these are fires. And then in these pictures, there are no fires, and fed a bunch of images into that algorithm and had it basically look on its own, determine on its own what was a fire and what wasn't a fire.
Okay. And the idea is that these drones could be kind of flying over the state at all times, sort of monitoring these remote areas?
Yeah, exactly. So the state is very big. The U.S. is very big. And in these drones, they only have a limited battery life. And so that would be great if, you know, they could monitor at all times. But for us, you know, we're trying to be at least a little bit practical with what we're presenting. So we actually, by talking with various firefighters, they told us that they have these red flag alerts that they get from the weather services. And so if an area has very high temperature, very low humidity, you know, high winds, they can deem it at risk for basically wildfire spreading very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now they have certain procedures in place where if they get a red flag warning in that area, the fire department will say, hey, we need more resources to be deployed in the case that a fire does break out. But what we're trying to do is on the preventative detection side. And so before a wildfire breaks out, we're looking at these areas to make sure that we monitor it more regularly than we would otherwise.
So I want to talk now about the ways in which wildfires are detected now. Like, do we generally at this point have to kind of wait until they're really big and somebody notices or reports it?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, that was part of our research for this project, and we were very surprised that most of these wildfires are detected manually. They said that most of it is just reported by people who happen to stumble upon a wildfire. And they also have, you know, lookout towers where there are literally just people standing there with binoculars, you know, looking every which way for fires. And we were so surprised because, you know, we're in the 21st century. This is 2018. We thought there would be, you know, more advanced technology. And they do have some technology, but very little of it is being used, at least by the people that we spoke to. So they have technology, but it's not as common as one would think in this day and age.
Yeah.
And it was funny because one of the things they talked about was heat technology. So they would fly helicopters and then they would have heat sensors to look for fires that way. But they said that in Arizona during the summer when, you know, wildfires are common, it's so hot that they'll just think, you know, the entire state is on fire.
Might not work in the right way. Right, right. Okay. So this is a way in which we could detect these much earlier on, and that could obviously make a big difference.
Exactly.
But there are some challenges with this. You mentioned the battery life of drones. What are some of the other challenges you think that this kind of idea might face?
Yeah, well, the first is the regulations, especially in the U.S. Typically, you know, when we look at, if you just Google like wildfire drone, you can't fly a drone. You know, it's prohibited, right?
Right. They can't send up their planes to fight the wildfire if there's a drone nearby. That's been an issue.
Yeah, exactly. And so we spoke with the Arizona Interagency Fire Center about our idea. They were very excited, but they're like, hey, we have this, you know, like 40-page document of protocols and rules, and it was literally something like procedures for unmanned aircraft and wildfires, like exactly what we needed. And so there, you know, there are a lot of, you know, regulations and hoops we have to jump through. But our goal is to partner with probably the state government. And so obviously they have, you know, if you go through the right procedures, there are ways around it.
So as you look forward, I know this is up for some prizes, some prize money. And you're working with the state now. As you look forward and work on making this a reality, what are your hopes? Like, what kind of difference do you think this kind of technology could make?
Yeah, you know, so we're doing research in 2017. I mean, these are all estimates, but they said that hurricanes cost the economy about $200 billion, the U.S. economy, and then wildfires were just below that at $180 billion. And, you know, thinking about hurricanes and wildfires, yes, they're both natural disasters. But hurricanes, you have one coming, you can't stop it. You kind of just get away from it and brace yourselves. Fires, if you can stop it in its early stages, you know, because, like, if you see a small fire, stopping it is at this point, it's not that difficult anymore. Yeah. And so if you don't see it, if you don't detect it, it can spread acres in a very short amount of time. And so if we can have this technology to just detect it, just let the firefighters know where they are. I mean, you know, we have the potential to, you know, have a lot of impact, not just for the economy, but, you know, also saving some lives. There are firefighters who risk their lives every day. And the bigger the fire gets, the more difficult it becomes to contain and the riskier it is for firefighters out there.
Yeah. All right. Murong Ha, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And this is KJZZ. You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, Kendall Blust reports from KJZZ's Hermosillo, Mexico Bureau.
In Mexico, the left-wing Morena Party is sweeping local, state, and federal races, and the border state of Sonora is no exception. The election won't mean a new governor for Arizona's neighbor, but it could represent changes for the cross-border relationship. Morena is winning big in historically right-leaning conservative Sonora. Candidates are coming out on top in congressional races, 20 of 21 state legislative districts, and as mayor in every major Sonoran city. The new party says it represents change and has promised to end corruption and generate jobs. That won't mean an end to close ties with Arizona, but it could mean some adjustments. Jacobo Mendoza is the leader of Morena in Sonora.
Debe de cambiar en un sentido de...
He says the cross-border relationship needs to benefit the interests and citizens of both countries, that it should be based on mutual respect. But Sonora's right-wing governor has 3 years left in office and has a close relationship with Arizona's Doug Ducey. Mendoza says his party will work with the governor on binational interests. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
From the business desk, here's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein.
All you have to do is drive around Phoenix for a few minutes, and you'll probably notice there's a housing boom going on. Apartment complexes seem to be going up on every corner.
And if you've tried to rent at any of those complexes, you've probably noticed that rental prices are going up as well.
In fact, as the Arizona Republic noted, Metro Phoenix renters need to earn almost $20 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment here, and most don't.
That is just one of the reasons that Lisa Glow, CEO of the Central Arizona Services, says we are in the middle of an affordable housing crisis in the Valley. And she says it's leading to a rise in homelessness here. CAS, located in downtown Phoenix, is the largest homeless emergency shelter in the state, and their numbers are on the rise. Glow recently came into our studios to talk about that phenomenon and what's behind it.
It really is a matter of not planning for a future, and this is going to play out across our country. It happened in Los Angeles, where they have 57,000 homeless people, and they're now planning to build more affordable housing to deal with that crisis. Mm-hmm. In Arizona, that's where we're going. So I'll give you a context. So when Governor Janet Napolitano was governor, we had about $40 million plus in the Housing Trust Fund, and that's a state fund that helps us build affordable housing. That trust fund now is under $4 million. So we need our governor to step up, we need legislative officials to step up, we need the business community to step up and help bring reinvestment so we have that housing again. Mm-hmm. To put it in context, there's a need for 200,000 affordable units. So for every 100 low-income earners or people looking for affordable housing, there are 20 units available.
Wow.
That's the crisis. So that's one problem. And then we have the second highest eviction rate in the country. So as rents rise, even people who are working can't afford their rents. We see a lot of people at our emergency shelter, our homeless shelter, who've been evicted.
Okay, so there are a lot of things that go into this. How many people is this affecting? We know homelessness is on the rise. Do you have numbers?
Well, every year, one day a year, there's something called the point in time count, where we go out and count, volunteers count how many people are in the community, how many are staying in shelters. Mm-hmm. We know the number is undercounted because you're not counting people couch surfing and so on. So just in Maricopa County, the number has gone up every year by 25 to 27% for the last 3 years. So in real numbers, that's around 6,200, but the number is probably more like 15,000 of mm-hmm. people who are homeless. But you have to consider also people on the brink of homelessness, and that's where you've got to understand the changing demographics of homelessness, which I'd love to talk about a little bit as
well. Yeah, so this isn't exactly everybody you would think of. This isn't just people who have mental illness. This is broader than that now.
It's far broader. So people who get evicted who have jobs, that's one category. The biggest concern we have right now is seniors, 55 and older, are the fastest growing segment of the homeless population across the country, and we're seeing it in our shelter. Most concerning are people who are 62 and older, and we had a lot of them stay in our emergency shelter last year, the oldest being an 89-year-old woman who came in with a walker.
Wow.
So her Social Security is not enough to cover her living expenses. Add some other complications, a medical illness, fraud, which there was fraud in her case, and they end up homeless. Veterans continue to be a large majority of the homeless population. Youth who are aging out of foster care, I mean, where are they going to find an affordable place to live? They've already got a lot of challenges. The working poor that I've already talked about, the medically frail, the mentally ill, there's simply not a safety net. Too many people are one paycheck away, or there's a crisis awaiting that yeah. will put them into homelessness.
Yeah. So that's a growing population. There are, though, supposed to be programs in place to help this. Like, so HUD has subsidies in place for people who do not have the money or do not make the money to pay for even low-income housing. There's affordable housing that's subsidized by the federal and the state government out there. Is that not enough? Or are those programs being cut? Why isn't that working?
Well, there's not enough. We're under-resourced. And there are proposals at the federal level to make additional cuts. And 89,000 Arizonans under a proposal under the Trump administration could result in a major rent increase for people who are on fixed incomes or have disabilities and are relying on those subsidies to help them with their rent. If this happens, we're going to have more people seeking shelter. Our shelter, we can only shelter 600 people a night. That includes our family shelter and our adult shelter, which is the largest one in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So 470 beds is not enough to meet the crisis, for the adult crisis mm-hmm. and the family crisis, too. There are other family shelters that are burgeoning. We're all already under-resourced. So if you make any cuts, it trickles down.
So affordable housing is one thing that needs to happen. If that doesn't happen, I mean, that's looking at the federal government's funding, which is something that, you know, we might not have control over here. What is a group like yours able to do? What can the community do to try to address something like this?
Well, the funding needs to come at the state level, too. And we all need to be concerned because it's not just impacting the individuals and the families. It's impacting the values in our neighborhoods. It's impacting the business we attract to our state. It's just not that simple. The economic development impacts need to be considered. Let me just say we're at a real turning point. We've got to take action. So I would say our governor, our legislature, our elected officials, our business leaders, our developers have to come together around public-private solutions. So we need more investments in affordable housing. We absolutely need more emergency shelter, which is what CAS does. We have 470 adult beds. Cities of smaller sizes, like Salt Lake City, they have 1,200 beds. So we are pushing to get more beds. When you get people off the streets, help them stabilize, then you've got to have a place for them to go. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of the population we serve, that place isn't there. So funding for shelter, funding for affordable housing, and funding for mental health services, all of those are still lacking.
So when you talk to somebody whose only experience with homelessness is seeing somebody every day on the side of the street with a sign saying, you know, anything helps. Like, for those people and who would assume, you know, that person could get housing if they wanted to or, you know, maybe has a drug problem or something like that, what do you say to them?
Let me give you some stories. If it's not enough that this is a sort of a morality crisis, it's the stories of the senior citizens who come in, the 73-year-old Vietnam vet, the 89-year-old woman whose son was stealing her pension, mm-hmm. the family, a single mom who was experiencing domestic violence. She and her five children came to our shelter. We got them housed, and then her mother got ill. She had to go to Texas. She lost her job. She needed $200 to pay her rent. They ended up on the street. She got evicted. So real people who are working, senior citizens who don't have the resources, veterans. It's a matter of our humanity with our homeless neighbors. We need to understand who they are. We need to take the time to care.
All right. Lisa Glow, the CEO of CAS, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.